Hello and welcome to Cage Club, two fans, 74 movies, one cage. Today's movie is Con Air from 1997, the second of Cage's three big action movies. I'm Joey Lewandowski.
I'm Mike Manzi.
And with us today we have another guest, Mike Milnes, who Mike and I both went to school with, so we have a couple Mikes here today. So Mike, welcome to the podcast.
Hi guys.
I think the answer might be obvious. Why did you want to do Con Air?
Where do I start? I guess this one goes back to when I was a kid, because I remember my dad saying to me that Nick Cage was trying to be the next action hero. And I was like, what? What are you talking about, Nicolas Cage? You know, because it was the mid-90s. What was Schwarzenegger and Stallone doing at that point? Nothing, really. I mean,
nothing really. No,
probably
you're
Eraser,
right,
or something like that. And I don't know what Stallone was doing. He was the beginning of this next generation of action heroes. And even though he didn't go much further than this, this is such a huge movie for him to do. Like, of course people would think he was an action hero after watching him in this movie.
It's awesome in every way.
It really is. And I'm a big fan of cheesy movies, so this one is right up there.
I guess it's sort of important to distinguish between, like, bad movies and, like, bad movies. Like, yeah, we've seen some bad movies on this podcast. But this one, I don't think this is bad. I mean, it's not necessarily, I mean, sort of the same things that we were talking about for The Rock apply here, right? It's not necessarily 100% believable. It's over the top. It's a little bit crazy. It's not really grounded in reality, but it all comes together within the logic of this world, and it all makes sense, and it's all just like a delight to watch.
Oh, yeah. I always felt like it's a very well-done movie. Really well-made, and it looks great.
Yeah, this is certainly, you know, quality-wise, this is leaps and bounds above a lot of Cage films. You know, it's certainly no Time to Kill. That is a far worse film than this, but I hear what you're saying. It adheres to the tropes of action movie. You know, this is just smack dab in the center of that genre, right? Everything from Die Hard to Last Boy Scout to Lethal Weapon, it almost all culminates here in a weird way. It's a star-studded ensemble. Like, how many action films really are kind of like that? Not many. And also, it's like a villain film as well. You know, what I would imagine like a Sinister Six movie might almost be like in a way.
Oh, yeah.
So it's really weird how Cage is like the only good guy. I don't know. It's strange. Like, he's in it less than I was expecting. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
To be the star, to be the main action guy, like, he's almost overshadowed.
And he's top billed, too. I mean, he's number one on the call sheet. And you're right, like, it's kind of John Malkovich's movie for the most part, and also sort of John Cusack. Like, it's kind of this triumvirate of Cage, Cusack, and Malkovich that make up the movie.
Yeah, I don't know if I would have called it a Nick Cage movie. There's so many big names.
It's weird because, you know, we'll get into the plot and everything, but it's certainly his journey. It just feels like he gets wrapped up in this, I don't know, almost like he steps into this other world in a way on his way home. You know, like, he stumbles off the path and, you know, I don't know. It's weird. It starts as his movie and it just sort of, he becomes like a passenger, right, on this other story.
Yeah. So a little groundwork. Movie was directed by Simon West, who will return to direct Cage much later in his career when he directs Stolen, which I think comes out in 2012. It was written by Scott Rosenberg, who will also write Gone in 60 Seconds. It's produced by Jerry Bruckheimer, who just produced The Rock. And also, actually, going back to screenwriting, it was touched up by that guy Jonathan Hensley, who Bruckheimer brought on board to touch up The Rock, too. In addition to the actors, which we'll get into when we get to them in the movie, there's a lot of, like, Cage connections behind the scenes and in front of the camera. Everything's sort of coming together in terms of this big blockbuster 90s action movie.
It's weird that we mentioned how this movie looks a lot like The Rock, you know, and it almost feels like a companion piece in a lot of ways. I don't know. It's just, it's got the same sort of feel and the vibe and the essence. And I almost wonder if that is the Bruckheimer touch, you know, because we have a different director, yet it almost feels like the same director, you know, like it almost feels like Bruckheimer's the guy, not Michael Bay, not Simon West. Like, it's Bruckheimer who's sort of got the look, you know, he brings use the cool gloss. He makes sure, like, the action's readable. He makes sure the shots are what we need. And I don't know, like, watching this movie, it made me just wonder, like, how much influence he really did have.
I definitely think that's a good point. Face Off definitely feels like a John Woo movie, right? Like, it definitely feels like a different kind of breed. But these two do feel very sort of similar. And, I mean, I guess that's also maybe a critique or a commentary on the time. Like, they're made a year apart. This is how action movies were made at the time, but I also do think that what you're saying is true. It holds a lot of water. It is sort of the Bruckheimer effect.
It feels like his movie. It's got that feel to it, the whole thing. What I like about it, in difference to the Rock, is that Cage plays such a different character here.
Yeah.
Where in The Rock, you could call that an action movie, absolutely, but he wasn't the action star. He's the star in this movie. He's the guy. He beats the shit out of these guys at the beginning of this movie. I rewound that scene. Watching him in other movies, he's had to have trained hard for this.
You're definitely right. Like, in The Rock, he's playing more of, like, the guy he played in Honeymoon in Vegas. You know, like, this nervous guy. And in here, you're right, he's like the Army Ranger. He's the Marine, or, you know, he's the stoic badass who's already, you know, fully formed and, you know, ready to go. And those are definitely the distinct difference, you know, with his character, for sure. Absolutely.
Yeah, Larson made a good point last movie when he was talking about The Rock, that John Cusack in Con Air is kind of playing the Nicolas Cage role in The Rock, which is true. Like, they're both normally behind the desk, sort of have to get their hands a little dirtier than they normally would, but you're right, like, it is sort of, it's a different kind of role than from The Rock, and he's more just in it in this movie.
Yeah, and like Mike said, he's got the moves, like, he pulls out, like, the roundhouse kicks and stuff like that, and, like, the kung fu, the karate, and even later on, like, those are his moves, you know, he will come back to the roundhouse kicks and stuff, like, it's his signature, and the dude is so tall and stuff, like, his legs get that reach. I was like, oh my god, like, why would you mess with him? He looks like a monster at the beginning of this movie, too. He's jacked again like he was in Kiss of Death, you know, like, he's definitely showing his strength here.
Speaking of his physique, during setups, Nicolas Cage would lift weights off camera to maintain the physique he had attained for the film. It's not only that he just, like, looks jacked for this movie, like, he was actively on set ensuring that he remained jacked. It's very evident that he is, like, committed to this role and committed to this physical demeanor. This is kind of the ultimate Cage movie in terms of Cage connections. The movie starts off and he is returning home from his time as an Army Ranger, and we've seen him in a lot of, you know, different Army and Marines and all that sort of different stuff. Vietnam mentioned early in the movie. Again, really early in the movie, he beats a guy to death for the third time
the
with his bare hands.
The third time in his career. Oh, he beats a guy to death with his bare hands.
And he totally could have avoided it, too.
They say, like, later in the movie, right? He was just protecting his girl, sort of, right?
Yeah,
like,
there's a moment with that scene we'll talk about, but he kind of gets screwed into his sentence a little bit, you know? Like, there was no evidence, the knife was missing, and all that, you know, I don't know. I feel with that knife, he might have gotten off a little bit better.
So one thing that's sort of interesting to point out about this scene is that the movie basically starts with kind of like a little, not montage, but set to this song, How Do I Live?, which is like a massive, massive hit. I found out that it was written for this movie, which is crazy. And interestingly enough, it was nominated for an Oscar for Best Original Song, and it was nominated for a Razzie for Worst Original Song. Sort of, you know, explains or describes the relationship between Cage, who plays Cameron Poe, and his wife. How do they live without the other one there? Like, this is sort of a action movie version of Wild at Heart, right? Like, he beats a man to death protecting his girl, and the girl that he is destined to be with forever.
Yeah, and even much like that movie, he meets his kid for the first time, right, after coming out of prison. There's a lot of parallels to that. They take the whole movie. This movie takes, like, 5 minutes to cover, like, the course of 8 years worth of stuff. Going quickly back to the song, though, I remember this sort of being a trend during the time. I remember when Kevin Costner was Robin Hood, there was like a Bryan Adams song. Going further back, like Karate Kid Part 2, I remember like a song coming out for that. All these like romance songs made specifically for movies, like becoming big mainstream hits. It's like a thing of the past that's just like regulated to Bond themes now. But yeah, that's a really interesting situation there. Like basically it's like a music video for How Do I Live Without You, this little opening part where Cage comes home to meet his wife. I'm in awe of how brilliant like the shorthand is, you know, just for storytelling. Like I said, like they take like 5 minutes to tell what most movies would take like an hour and a half. You know, this would be a whole other movie to me, where this guy comes home to his little town and like has to deal with, you know, the locals harassing like him as a veteran and stuff. And this fight is insane. It's in the rain, but they're next to an oil refinery, so there's fire and water going on. It's like very crazy.
Also in this scene, worth pointing out, there's a red car. It's not a red sports car. It's like a red muscle car, but it's kind of close.
That's the thing, Mike. If you see like a red car, it's kind of been like a warning in Nick Cage movies. Like a red car will sort of show up. I mean, maybe it's just like our imaginations, but if a red car shows up, like it's not a good sign most of the time.
But you're right. Like you sort of made this reference earlier, right? He sort of has a little bit of bad luck that they sort of jump him and she goes inside to call the cops. He doesn't intentionally, but he beats the guy to death with his bare hands. He kills the guy. He gets arrested. His lawyer says, hey, if you plead guilty, like you'll only have to serve a year. Yeah. You know, if you don't plead guilty, if they just like, if you go to trial, you might see 10 years in jail. And so it's sort of some bum lawyer advice, but like this is sort of what sets us on this path for this entire movie.
I guess that's bum advice. What I like about this part and this movie in general is that it wants to get to the point. It wants to get to like the action, to the bad guys, and to the interesting stuff. Who really cares why he goes to jail and what happens in between, really? The fact that he gets this lawyer, I guess maybe a public defender, that there's no like military attorney.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking too. And the judge, right? The judge is like, you were trained by the military, so you're considered a lethal weapon, right? Like your hands are basically like knives or like guns. Like, you know,
yeah, the same thing.
And so he's like, because of that, like, I'm kind of going to throw the book at you, right? He, like, gives him 7 years or something. And I'm thinking, like, judge, like, I think you got it all wrong. Like, this guy is a military vet. Like, he fought for our country. Like, if anything, shouldn't he get, like, some kind of preferential treatment or, like, cut him some slack because he's been programmed by the government to murder people in self-defense?
How far did they look into this case, too? Yeah, all these details, but then nobody testifies that they were being harassed by these guys earlier in the night, and they were clearly instigated, and
yeah,
maybe
the guys that survived, right, that are in traction, like, we don't have a statement from them or anything.
That's why I think, like, I don't know if he necessarily gets bum advice, but it seems like the lawyer's not necessarily great at his job, right? He doesn't do the simple things of trying to get witnesses or trying to get whatever. And Cage gets locked up for 7 to 10, but that 7 to 10 year stretch takes only like 2 or 3 minutes in the movie. And the time goes by, like, it sort of doesn't matter. Like, it matters in his life, but not necessarily to the movie. The movie just needs him to get into jail so he can get out of jail. It's kind of like a really cool sort of time lapse, right? That they're using the letters that he's writing back and forth to his daughter, who he's never met because he doesn't want her to meet him while he's in jail. They're reading letters back and forth between the two of them, talking about sort of going up and down about her first day of school and about wondering if she's ever going to meet him. And it's just kind of great.
Dear Daddy, I started today at the Little Sunshine Day Care Center. My teacher is Miss Gordon. She is nice. We go to playtime and we all have to hold hands when we walk there.
Dear Casey, it was so good to read your letter. I'm glad you like your teacher. We don't exactly have a playtime like you. We do go outside, though, but normally we don't hold hands.
Dear Daddy, today was my first day at first grade. I didn't like it. I don't want to go back tomorrow. This boy, Scotty Dalton, has black teeth and calls me names. Mama says I have to go back. Tell her not to make me.
Dear Casey, hopefully this finds you still going to the first grade. School is very important. Your mama's right. Now don't you worry about little Scotty Dalton. Sometimes you meet people like that, but don't let them get you down.
Dear Daddy, are you ever coming home?
Dear Casey, And of course I'm coming home. But just a little while longer and all the things we missed doing together, you can be sure we'll do. Dear Hummingbird, break out the fine china, chill the lemonade, tie a yellow ribbon round the old oak tree, cause this boy's coming home to his ladies, coming home forever. I just hope I'm not a disappointment to Casey or to you. Love, Cameron.
It really hammers home that he's a good guy and he needs to get through this. It constantly reminds you that you're watching a movie where something bad is going to happen continuously. He just got home to see his wife. Then he gets arrested for murder. Spending time in jail. He's learning about his kid through these letters. So he's got this to look forward to. I'm going to be such a good guy. But hey, we've barely met this guy. It's only how much time are we into this movie?
Like 6 minutes?
Yeah. We see all these reasons to rehabilitate. Something's got to happen. It wouldn't be Con Air if he just got through jail.
The one missed opportunity I think that they have in jail is that, like, they're showing him learning how to do things, right? Like, he's learning how to speak Spanish, and he's learning origami, but, like, it would have been kind of cool for him to learn something in jail that they just show that they show him doing while we're hearing these letters that, like, pays off later in the film. But we don't get that. Like, we just sort of get...
Yeah.
It's just things to do while he's on screen.
We just need him to be a convict so that he can get on that Con Air. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Like, they need to transform this. We're getting, like, his arc, like, almost right here at the start out of the way, because they need to transform him from an Army Ranger to a convict. So we need to get that done. Lickety split. I think that's their main objective with this whole, like, prison sequence going on here. And just going back to the passage of time, I just love the way they show it. You're right, they should have set something up. He doesn't really use Spanish to any kind of varying degree. He doesn't use origami on anyone. But I just love how there's a riot going on one year, and he just pulls, like, the covers or the pillow over his head, and it just gives you this sense that he's not this animal, right? Like, he has self-control. He's actually a genuinely, like, nice guy and, like, all this kind of stuff. Like, he doesn't belong there. It almost seems like he always ends up in these places he just doesn't belong in. He's just got the worst luck.
No, you're right. Like, he doesn't belong there, and the only reason, or, like, what brings him through all of this is just thinking about his daughter, right? Like, after he gets released with Baby O, his prison mate, his sole driving factor, like, his motivation is just to get back to his daughter. Like, he's on the bus with the guard, and some other inmates might be acting up, and she's just trying to assess the situation, and he's like, here, take a look at my daughter, isn't she adorable?
Cameron Poe.
Yes, ma'am.
You know, you're still under full restraints to your process and release from your original prison, understand?
Yes, ma'am. As long as I make it home on time and makes no never mind. It's my daughter's birthday.
Well, congratulations.
I got locked down 3 months before she was born. She ain't never seen me.
And why not?
No way was she gonna meet her daddy in a prison visitor room surrounded by homemade cookies and love-starved murderers. No way.
What you got here is a walking, talking reason to rehabilitate.
That is the most ridiculous conversation I've ever heard. He just wanted to... Oh, man, he pushes it hard. This is my daughter, and she, like, even turns to walk away, and he's like, nope, look at this.
You sort of get the sense that, like, everybody he passed on the way out the prison, right? He's just showing, hey, look, here's my daughter. Like, check her out. Isn't she cute?
What I really loved was, he's been like a cigar store Indian most of this movie, like, so far. Just, like, very quiet and pensive and stuff. But when he gets paroled, he, like, breaks down and hugs Baby O and starts, like, crying and stuff. Like, that was really, I felt like that was, like, good to show, you know, because we're not going to see any of that. And that's the way getting to see his daughter makes him feel. So that's the feeling he's going to be sort of chasing again for, like, the rest of the movie. That's the way I was looking at it almost. So I think one of the main things that this voiceover sort of establishes is Nick Cage's accent, where he, you know, uses accents fairly often, and it just, he sounds like H.I. from Raising Arizona.
He does.
Maybe it's his, like, older kick-ass brother or something like that. They're related.
That's the first thing I wrote down. As soon as he opened his mouth, I was like, that accent. Where is he supposed to be from? Alabama?
He's flying back to Alabama, so I'm guessing he was born in Alabama.
Okay, is that an Alabama accent?
Here's another little bit of trivia. Nicolas Cage traveled to Alabama to perfect his accent, so I would take it to believe, I mean, we've seen him do all sorts of accents, we've seen him do all sorts of things through these 29 movies so far. I am trusting in his dedication as an actor that he has the Alabama accent perfected.
I second that, because I've never been down there. I don't know what an authentic accent from there sounds like, so I'm just going to go with what I learn in the movies. And Cage hasn't let me down that much, so I'm going to buy it. I buy this accent.
I will agree. I mean, I bet he put the time in, but I bet even harder that no one else put the time in, so their accents are not even close to what they should be.
We'll say that Cage sets the bar for realism, and if they're not on his level in terms of accents, they're not as committed as he is.
That's actually a good way to look at the rest of this film, right? Like, so what we've seen so far has established, like, the reality of this world. And we know how, like, fast-paced and crazy and extreme it's been, and it's only been, like, 8 minutes. Yeah, I like that. Like, you know, as long as they don't go sort of too far out of the zone of what Cage is doing, I'm gonna buy whatever else these other guys are going to bring to this movie.
It's at this point in the movie that we see the other thing, sort of the inciting event, right? That we meet John Cusack, who is he's a U.S. Marshal, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we see the DEA agents led by Colmeany, right?
Yeah, they're Larkin and Malloy is what I kept referring to them as.
Larkin and Malloy.
It's the bureaucracy here.
And it's sort of, I mean, we've seen this kind of bickering between departments in past movies, most notably in Kiss of Death, right? Where it's just these two sides that ultimately are after the same thing, but they don't have the same way of getting there. They're going to put an undercover DEA agent on the plane so that he can sit next to this guy, Sandino, get him to confess to some crimes, because apparently when he's around prisoners, he likes to run his mouth a little bit and brag about what he's done. And so they're sending this DEA agent on the plane as a criminal to get a little bit more information from the Sandino guy. Colmeany, or Malloy, is like dead set on giving him a gun, and Larkin, John Cusack, is like, no, 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 nobody goes on this plane with a gun. So he's like, all right, fine, no gun. But then you see him, like, when they're loading up the prisoners a little bit later, they put a gun on. So, like, it's like here that bureaucracy is just the downfall of society, basically, right?
Yeah, this is like a big scene for exposition. This is a huge info dump going on, because not only do we learn that Nick Cage is going to get a ride, he's got parole, so he needs a ride back to where he was processed in Alabama, so that he's going to hitch a ride on Con Air. And now Con Air is like a prison plane where it's designed to transport prisoners, but on this specific day, they're transferring like the worst of the worst from the East Coast, like to some new Supermax prison somewhere off the grid. I don't know. I'm thinking it's the one from Face Off we're going to see next time. Then we learn that there's a marshal running this whole operation, but a DEA agent wants to sneak one of his guys on board because one of these, like, worst of the worst is a cartel drug lord guy, and they need to know, like, the whereabouts of his brother. I don't know. There's a lot.
It ultimately, like, doesn't really matter. What this movie does really well, like, giving you just enough to show you, like, how badass these guys are, and then that's it. Like, they're just, like, they're taking all these different people from a whole different bunch of places, and then just throwing them together on a plane. It doesn't matter, like, who's there or why they're there, because the whole plan's going to go to shit in a little bit anyway. They just want to introduce all these people and just say, there's a reason, like, just trust us, there's a reason they're all on this plane, but, like, we're going to throw them all into this melting pot and just see what happens.
Well, we told you today's flight would be special. That's William Bedford, a.k.a. Billy Bedlam.
Mass murderer?
The same. He caught his wife in bed with another man, left her alone, drove four towns over to his wife's family's house, killed her parents, her brothers, her sisters, even her dog.
Scan him!
And who is that good-looking brother on screen?
Nathan Jones, a.k.a. Diamond Dog, former general of the Black Guerrillas. He blew up a meeting of the National Rifle Association saying, and I quote, they represented the basest negativity of the white race. He wrote a book in prison called Reflections in a Diamond Eye. New York Times called it a wake-up call for the black community. They're talking to Denzel for the movie. This one's done it all. Kidnapping, robbery, murder, extortion.
Foxtrot Charlie, perimeter is secure. You are cleared to release.
His name is Cyrus Grissom, a.k.a. Cyrus the Virus. 39 years old, 25 of them spent in our institution. But he's bettered himself inside, earned 2 degrees, including his Juris Doctor. He also killed 11 fellow inmates, incited 3 riots, and escaped twice. Likes to brag that he killed more men than cancer.
Okay, open wide. Lift your tongue.
You get a lot of personalities right away. A lot of people establish themselves pretty quick. Dave Chappelle is in there. Nobody really knew Dave Chappelle yet. And Malkovich, you knew he was a good actor. but he was never really a bad guy.
Yeah, this part with loading the prisoners is really cool. It's like the roll call, right? It's like we see the first set of prisoners. So I wrote down their names because everybody's got like a pseudonym. There's like Billy Bedlam. Then there's Ving Rhames coming back from Kiss of Death,
yeah,
which he was in. And he plays Diamond Dog. Now, Diamond Dog is the name of a Bowie album. Last episode on The Rock, there was someone named Major Tom. So yeah. I'm wondering if this is Bruckheimer just sneaking in his love of Bowie.
Bruckheimer or maybe Hensley, like one of those two with their hands on the movie.
And then Chappelle's name is Pinball Parker. They never really give his reason, like most of them have a reason for their name. Like Cyrus the Virus is called a virus because he's killed more people than cancer. Like,
right.
That's the reasoning, but I don't know what Pinball Parker's reasoning was, but I just love that everybody's got like this dossier. And then we get to Cameron Poe, and dude, he's like, oh, he's a nobody.
Hey, Larkin, who's that guy?
That is Cameron Poe, a parolee hitching a ride home. He's a nobody.
Like, it's not like he's an army special ranger who committed manslaughter. It's like he's a nobody. Like, you think like if they just knew his background that would come in handy when the plane gets hijacked. They're just like, maybe. That's a nobody.
We also meet Johnny 23, right? Danny Trejo.
Oh yeah.
Who's been accused of raping 23 girls or convicted of raping 23 girls. He's got a little rose tattoo on his arm for each of his ladies.
Call me Johnny 600 if they knew the truth.
Yeah, it doesn't have quite the same ring to it. Anyway, I despise rapists. For me, you're somewhere between a cockroach and that white stuff that accumulates at the corner of your mouth when you're really thirsty. But in your case, I'll make an exception.
Everybody is just like comically larger than life. It's so perfect within the universe of the film.
Each character is played so well. Danny Trejo is perfect for that.
Actual convict too. So I mean, plays
that's
the
right.
part.
Yeah.
Once they load everybody on the plane, we really quickly get a sense of what's going to happen and how it's going to happen. That Cyrus and Diamond Dog both have little needles in their hand, and they take them out, they extract them slowly and uncuff their wrists, their handcuffs. Dave Chappelle had swallowed lighter fluid in a match and like spits it up and soaks the Indian guy and then lights him on fire. In the mayhem that sort of creates, he goes and lets Cyrus out of his cell and then ultimately lets Diamond Dog out of his cell. And that's like the beginning of the end, that all hell has already broken loose, and we're like 25 minutes into this movie.
Yeah, and when Cochise goes up in flames, I'm just loving it because, you know, guy on fire action movie trope. You know, he's got to be there somewhere. And I'm wondering, how are they going to set someone on fire in an airplane? And I was, oh, right away is how. it's like on takeoff. It was just amazing. It's so orchestrated. Like, everyone's got the pins. Everyone's got the timing and those hand signals or whatever. Like, this seems like overtly well planned, you know, for these guys who I don't know if they've had much contact with each other. Judging by the way they're traveling, they've all have like their own cell somewhere in solitary. It's a great like over the top takeover.
As this is all going crazy, the pilot and the co-pilot are like, what's going on back there? And the co-pilot goes back to check it out with the gun, and Malkovich like knocks him out and steals the gun and then delivers the film's titular line.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is your captain speaking.
I have the only gun on board. Welcome to Con Air.
And meanwhile, throughout all this, like, Cage, like, isn't doing anything. Like, obviously he wasn't part of the plan, but he's not really trying to stop anything. He's just trying to get by, sort of fly under the radar. He's just trying to get back to Alabama to see his wife and to see his daughter.
Can we just go back to this plan that the bad guys had?
Sure.
Because it's executed perfectly from start to finish. How did they do that? How did they coordinate all that?
I feel like where this is sort of like sliding doors, right? Where there's all these alternate realities and this is the one reality where everything went to plan. The easy answer is that this is an action movie and things just have to happen right. I mean, the gun doesn't necessarily have to come out of the cockpit. They don't need the gun to really sort of pull off the plan. They have the muscle. There aren't that many guards on the plane. They make a really clear point early in the movie, right? Like, nobody on board is carrying. They don't have to worry about guns. They just have to really sort of worry about hand-to-hand combat. And these are all, like, big dudes who are going to be able to overpower the guards, even if they're great guards. Yes, like, everything works perfectly, but it's not, like, completely unrealistic. It's just that they get a little bit lucky. Once the dominoes start falling, everything falls in their favor.
Yeah, I almost imagine like they had like the start of a plan, and then they realize like as they're going to cause chaos, as long as they keep their cool and have an objective to like open those doors, like, you know, that's what they stick to. And like they were just sort of, everything else was sort of by the fly almost. I'm going with it. That's all I can say. At this point too, we should bring up Baby-O isn't really feeling too well, and he's going to become major plot point here for Cage, at least.
Yeah, Baby-O's diabetic. In all this chaos that happens, all the needles get broken, and so he can't get his insulin shot, which he was due for like hours earlier. Like when they're on the bus to get loaded onto the plane, he's asking for it then. And so he's really the reason that Cage, a little bit later, Cage has the opportunity to get off the plane, but he feels this prison bond to Baby-O and wants to make sure that he gets taken care of, because nobody else on the plane, aside from the guard who's now chained up in the cage, nobody's going to take care of Baby-O, and he's just going to die if Cage gets off the plane.
And now, was Baby-O being transferred to the Supermax, or...?
I think so. I don't know. Like, he sort of feels like he's getting out. Like, they're obviously all criminals, right? But, like, they're not... Like, he's sort of in the same cell block... Well, I don't know, because like
no
Billy
way
Bethlehem's
he's like in the same league as like Diamond Dog, the militant guy who wants to like take over, kill all the white men.
He sits next to Cage, you know, who's getting out. So they obviously don't have any sense of danger from this guy. If I remember correctly, he's being transferred to another prison.
The plane is making multiple stops, right? They're not all necessarily going up to this end gate, like this maximum security prison in Alabama or wherever.
Because Cusack even says that Poe's just hitching a ride. So maybe they were meant to get off somewhere other than this maximum security, and who knows, maybe that was the first stop.
It's not like a huge issue for me, because I don't have a problem with, like, I like the way they incorporate like Baby-O and stuff, but they only really are planning to stop at Carson City. That's all they, and they have like a transfer list, and he's not on it, so I don't know.
The other big thing that happens at this point in the movie is that this DEA agent, this undercover DEA agent, it's kind of like a cool reversal, right? Like, we set him up that he's going to be there all movie and sort of figure out a way to overthrow Malkovich, and, or at least get some information with Sandino. But, like, he gets on the plane, and then in this whole ruckus, pulls out his gun and is killed by Malkovich. Like, they spend so much time debating, you know, how to get him on board. He's killed, like, within 10 minutes of being on screen. Like,
it's kind of
like a cool little reversal.
He makes the dumbest cop move ever, too. He immediately pulls his gun, and he takes a hostage. Like, who gives a shit if you killed that guy? This is Cyrus the Virus. You're going to hold another prisoner hostage? He's just going to shoot the both of you. You know?
This is when it would have been good to know that there is an Army Ranger sitting next to you, too, and you had some time to keep your cool and gain your wits about your surroundings a little before just completely, like, revealing yourself. Like, yeah, guy is an amateur DEA agent at best.
Seriously,
but
what was the benefit of no one knowing who he was? The guards couldn't know who he was?
I think they just wanted to be realistic was their purpose. I don't know. Like, I guess they were worried that the guards would treat him a little bit differently if they knew.
Yeah, it's all just
DEAs
being dicks and like bullying their way into this U.S. Marshal's jurisdiction. You know, I think that's like a lot of what it is, where it's just like, you have something we want, we have the means to do anything we need to, so we're butting in on your operation, and like, you know, they just don't care, and it's all that kind of crap. Two agents are like constantly jockeying for position of this operation throughout the whole film.
Ultimately, you know, it is sort of the good agent, the likable agent that comes out on top, and he also even gets like a little bit of a screw you into Malloy a little bit later. But after this DEA agent falls, like, sort of all the opposition is down, like within a couple minutes. Like, they take out all the guards, or they incapacitate all the guards, they take out the co-pilot, they convince the pilot that they're in charge now, and there's really like no opposition, right? It's amazing how well their plan comes together, because they're just in charge like almost immediately.
I was thinking, like, they take this plane faster than Ed Harris took The Rock. they're probably more motivated, being, you know, criminals with life sentences and things like that, so they're very focused on their goal here today.
It's worth talking about their plan, right? Because part of the plan, like the big part of their plan, was that Sandino convinced at least Cyrus that there's this plane in this airstrip in Nevada that I'm going to be able to get us on, and we're going to fly to a country with no extradition, and we're just going to get out of here, and it's going to be great. And so their whole plan is to basically, pardon the pun, but like fly under the radar and sort of make it seem like everything's normal until they get to this airstrip, and then at least Cyrus and Sindino and maybe Diamond Dog or whoever, they're all going to take off from there. To keep to the plan, the first thing that they have to do is land at Carson City and do this, like, inmate exchange where they get, like, 6 off or 6 on, 10 off or whatever, make it seem like the convicts are not flying the airplane.
Yeah, and this is just where I wonder, what was John Cusack, the U.S. Marshal, in charge of this flight? What was he thinking? He's like, we're going to stop and pick up 6 more, like, of the world's most dangerous people because it's not packed enough on this. We haven't overbooked it yet.
Like, Cyrus is pretty, like, a pretty big badass, right? There's, like, an even bigger, like, badass, like, that they're going to pick up soon, which is also a returning Cage Connection. 3 of the people who were supposed to get off were killed in the ruckus, and so they're trying to decide who's going to get off, who's going to come on. Cage and Baby-O were volunteered to get off. Oh, no, they're expecting white guys. Like, Baby-O, you got to stay. And so Cage is like, I'm going to stay then, too.
I want to stay on.
What?
Changed my mind.
So, Cyrus, we got a little mind changer.
I got 15 years left, and I know I'd just hate myself if I thought I blew my one shot at a naked party freak and an umbrella drink.
You got 15 years? Boy, a second ago, you couldn't wait to get off this plane.
And it's just like one of the many times in this movie, he has this opportunity to escape, but like he's such a good guy and so committed to Baby-O that he's willing to sacrifice his own life to save Baby-O instead of going to see his wife and daughter.
He makes that choice a lot. It's like I said before, he's like the ultimate good guy. It keeps you in the movie, too. Yes, he's in the thick of things, but he chooses to be there at the beginning of the movie when his wife says to him, you remind me of that old guy. There's a definite difference between him at the beginning of the movie and him on the plane. He holds back from doing anything, slow to make moves, but he's very calm and cool about it.
I was actually thinking that too, is that he knows that he has that guy in him, right? Like he's on this plane of convicts and he's looking around and he's probably saying to himself, like, this could have easily have been me if I wasn't, like, if I didn't meet that girl, if I didn't join the Rangers, you know, if I didn't meet Baby-O in prison, maybe I'd have lost it. Like, all these things are probably running through his head, and they're running through my head, too. I'm looking around going, like, does he belong with these guys? Like, is he going to turn at some point? Like, something, you just don't know, really, you know? And, like, yeah, I almost wish we knew what his checkered past was to a degree, but I think you're onto something there where it's just, like, he needs to do it as some kind of redemption to it. He needs to show himself that, like, he's a good person and all that kind of, right? Like, helping other people and putting his life on the line. Like, there's some sort of sense that he owes it to some degree.
Even Baby-O, who he's trying to, like, defend or sort of protect or make sure that he lives, is like, hey, like, think of your girl. Like don't care about me.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you're trying to be a good guy here, and, like, I understand that, like, you want to atone for something, maybe, but, like, there's more important things for you. Like, take care of yourself for the first time.
What the hell are you doing?
Stay in. They're gagging everybody for the bus ride to the pan. It'll be hours before the feds discover what happened. By then, you'll be dead. So will she.
Oh, think of your little girl.
Now, what would my daughter think of me if I let you like this to get disarmed and die?
You keep acting like you're still a ranger, we're all gonna be in trouble. You're not that guy anymore, you're a convict.
You can tell that he does think about his choices, and he thinks about them real hard, but you can also tell that which way he's leaning. As soon as this problem of, oh, my friend's in trouble, right away you go, oh, he's going to stay. It fits the whole time. It fits. Every time he makes this choice, it works.
There's this kind of cool moment where they take over the plane, and Johnny 23 is going to go rape the female guard. Poe is like, this ain't happening, right? And he kind of diffuses the whole thing and, like, ingratiates himself with Cyrus through that.
I can't allow that.
You know what I am?
Ugly all day. This ain't happening. Not here. Not now.
What's happening?
Hey!
Relax, he's right. Not here, not now. Do you fly, Johnny?
No.
You keep that in mind when you look at her, because if your dick jumps out of your pants, you jump out of this plane.
So it's weird, like, even amongst these thieves, like, he's, like, forming allegiances and alliances, and, you know, he's reading the code of honor between them. Like, I don't know, like, he can tell by the way they think that he knows, like, not everybody's down with this rapist.
But you hear it in real life, and it's also true within the confines of this movie, that there's sort of, like, a hierarchy in prison, right? Like, you know, rapists and child molesters are at the bottom rung. That's why Johnny 23, he has, like, this alpha dog personality. But, like, Malkovich is like, no, like, let's calm down a little bit. Like, you're not in the right here. Whatever Malkovich, you know, murderer, I guess, is kind of, like, respected in prison.
He's definitely some kind of, like, Lex Luthor-esque mastermind that is, like, very well known in this, you know, film universe. That because, like, everyone just, like, knows who he is, right? Like, even when he walks on the plane, like, Baby-O knows who he is, and they're not even in the same jail.
And so it's at this point where they find out that there's like a little soft wall in Cyrus's cell that he's got all these plans for the plane that they're going to have. He not only has that, but he's got like a little homemade bomb so that when they inevitably find his secret stash, they're not going to be able to do anything about it because it's just going to self-destruct.
One of the things that you see in there is the Anarchist Cookbook.
Yes.
Mike, I think you probably remember.
Yes.
Back in the 90s, that was a big deal. Internet was still kind of new. One of the things that you were able to download or look up or whatever was this Anarchist Cookbook. Give you recipes on how to make homemade explosives.
It was now, very strange because it almost felt to a degree like a sarcastic like parody book. Almost like the zombie survival guide, but it had like actual recipes in it, and you could find it on the shelf at a store somewhere. What I love about Cyrus's little like stash here is he laid it out so that by the time you figured out what he was doing, then you would find the bomb. So it was like the equivalent of revealing your master plan right before killing you without even being there.
What I also like about the way that he has a bomb, like it's in like a little lunchbox, right? And in the last movie in The Rock, there was a bomb in a baby doll. Like these two completely like harmless, you know,
childish kind of.
Exactly. They're both just holding like this dangerous like bomb that's threatening to blow up our main characters, right? Like Cage and The Rock and John Cusack here. They're like evil masqueraded in this like gentle little delicate whatever.
And this is sort of all being cross-cut with landing at Carson City for the prisoner exchange. I guess the main guy they want from this is the cartel guy, right? Francisco is going
to
be here.
This really motivates Cusack to like, he's like, okay, now I know that they have a plan. Like, we're going to find out. He finds the letter, right? And he finds the Last Supper.
The
and
codex.
He finds out that they're going to land at Carson City. And so this is sort of like him, like a little bit like National Treasure, like trying to find the clues, trying to get ahead of the plan, trying to figure out where they're going. And he figures it out, but like it's just too late. And so they you're right, like they cut to Carson City. They're picking up Sindino. They pick up Sally Can't Dance. They might pick up Swamp Thing.
Yeah, they pick up Swamp Thing, and he's the new pilot.
Yeah, because the pilot they put off, like he's one of the white guys that they need to make the exchange that, you know, again, like just crazy coordination that Malkovich not only is able to, you know, break out of his cell, but coordinate from another prison in another state this other guy that they're going to pick up who knows how to fly a plane. Like, it's just crazy, but it's also perfect.
That's what's amazing, too. Like, Swamp Thing, like, jumps on the plane and is like, yup, it's been taken over. Like, plans in motion. You know, where's the cockpit?
He goes into the cockpit and he takes out the transponder, and Dave Chappelle takes the transponder and brings in this little mom-and-pop tour of the Grand Canyon airline sort of thing. Like this like little like prop plane that you just like you pay like, you know, a couple hundred dollars and it'll take you over an aerial view of the Grand Canyon. And he tucks the transponder in there so that Cusack can't track it. And he almost misses the plane because this guy who's been locked up, he's more concerned with, like, you know, flirting with this girl. Like, it's just so great, this, like, little Chappelle moment. And from what I read, he apparently improvised most or all of his lines. Like, he's just so good in this scene. And there's just, like, so many moving parts, and he's just doing his one thing to get Con Air where it needs to be.
Yeah, this scene's pretty funny because we don't really get a lot of like interaction between prisoners and civilians in this movie, you know? And this is like one of the only like two or three times where a prisoner is like run into this person who's like got no clue what the hell is going on, like for real.
Yeah.
Like I thought that was really a nice little moment of levity.
One of the other times that like you really have an interaction between a criminal and a normal person is later in the movie, and it's terrifying and so scary, and that's with Garland Green and that little girl. And Garland Green, played by Steve Buscemi, reprising his Cage Club role from Zondali. He's like this most feared, most terrifying, like most pure evil. What does he do? He like kills and eats people?
He's like, basically like Hannibal Lecter. Like they wheel him out of his own truck and he's bound and gagged with like this bondage mask on, and he's got a straitjacket, and they're wheeling him into the plane and everything like that. And I think he's referred to as the Marietta Mangler.
Harassed in a cartoon.
Shit, that's Garland Green, man.
The Marietta Mangler.
That skinny little man butchers 30-something people up and down the eastern seaboard. They say the way he kills those people makes the Manson family look like the Partridge family.
Well, he's on the right flight.
Like, I love that it's Buscemi because he is the complete opposite of what you would imagine to be, like, in a sense. You know, like, he's this small, frail guy, but he's got, like, this larger-than-life, murderous reputation.
Yeah, like, all these guys who are on the plane, like, you know, you would believe that Malkovich or Ving Rhames or even, like, you know, MC Gainey, who plays Swamp Thing, like, these are all the guys who are, like, physically overpowering and intimidating, and they could easily kill a whole bunch of people. But Buscemi, like, you know that he's, like, the smartest guy on that plane because he figured out a way to sort of smart his way into 30 kills. The cops start to show up, right? Like Cusack sort of like signals ahead and they get the guards off, and Cage like sneaks a wire. Like he finds the wire that the DEA agent was wearing, and he sneaks that into one of the prisoners' like shirts. And they get on a bus, and like they find out just too late because Con Air is able to take off. Dave Chappelle is seemingly left behind. Like he was too busy flirting to get back onto this plane.
So we're in Cusack's office, I guess, where he's talking with Mrs. Poe. I got really confused. There's no telling on where he is at any given time, except when he has to get to Carson City.
You mean like geographically?
Yeah, maybe I missed it. He was suddenly in his office, because he's sitting there like it's his office, so I assume that's where he is. The other thing is, you don't know much time is really going by either. They were leaving from where to go to Carson City?
I don't know, I feel like it may be California?
Yeah, like it didn't seem like that long of a flight, but well, then...
But also somehow Cameron Poe's wife and daughter get from presumably Alabama to Carson City,
yeah,
or something,
to,
right?
Yeah, to, I guess, Carson City, but wherever it is, it's close to Vegas, too.
Well, why isn't Cameron Poe locked up in his own home state in the first place? Like, why is he, like, five states away?
If it's Alabama to California, like, that's, like, across the country pretty much. Like, doesn't make sense here.
But that's really what I love about this movie. This is what kind of makes it a bad movie. Because none of this stuff makes sense. But when it comes down to it, who the hell cares? It's so much fun.
It's because, like, he's talking to wherever this office is, it's because Cusack's talking to Cameron Poe's wife that he realizes that he has an ally on this plane. It's sort of confirmed a little bit later when the landing gear hasn't fully come up. Cage is, like, trying to figure out where they're going, and he gets tasked by Ving Rhames to go down and figure out what's going on down there. And they figure out that Dave Chappelle had climbed into the landing gear and, like, froze to death. And so Cage writes Cusack's character's name. He's like U.S. Marshal Larkin, and he pushes him out the plane. That is amazing. We can talk about that next. It's about halfway through the movie that Cusack realizes, oh, there's a good guy on this plane. Like we might not be lost. But let's talk about Chappelle for a second, and sort of like not necessarily his death scene, but his after death scene.
Thank God that dead guard had a pen, or else Cage was fucked. How else was he going to tell anybody? How else was he going to deliver a message? Thank God the dead guard that Dave Chappelle was wearing, the uniform he was wearing, had a pen in the pocket. That just cracked me up when I saw that.
He pushes Chappelle out, basically out the landing gear hole, and the landing gear comes up. And probably the funniest scene in the movie, right? A little bit of a Cage in action stretch. The car's being driven by Don S. Davis, who was Scully's father on The X-Files, died in the episode Beyond the Sea, where the villain was Brad Dourif of Amos Andrew. Mike pointed out this morning that he is from Twin Peaks. He's Bobby Briggs' dad, and there's a lot of Cage-Twin Peaks crossover. It's like this guy who's like tangentially affiliated with Cage up to this point, and Chappelle's body falls out of the plane, however thousands of feet up in the air it is.
Like 30,000 feet? And it's and
wrecks his car. Yeah, no, the body doesn't explode. And I guess it's one of the few times that there's a little bit of CGI or a little bit of computer tweaked things. Because Mike, you talked last time about how The Rock was no CGI. This has a little bit of CGI. It's just great.
What, like, incredibly quick thinking by Cameron Poe, too. I mean, he sees this opportunity to get a message to someone, you know? Like, who would have thought to, like, write the name, right? Like, here's where we're going on this guy's shirt, knowing that, like, you know, he knows, like, still the authorities will find this body, they'll find the name, they'll track it. That, like, he's so many steps ahead. Like, I don't know. It's just very cunning on his behalf. It's just cool how he's able to, like, instantly take this situation and, like, make something out of it.
Oh, so it's at this point, it might answer Mike's geography question that they're like, how far is it to Carson City or how far is it to wherever we need to get? They tell Cusack, like, you can get there quick enough if you have a fast car. And so he steals Malloy's sports car with a license plate ass kicker and drives there. So, I mean, like, it's drivable distance from wherever they are to wherever they're winding up, which I guess is near Vegas, right?
I think Malloy is, like, he's taking the choppers, and, you know, I call them firebirds because they're assault choppers and anything. So he jumps in those, and they go to track down what they think is Con Air, but they remember they put the tracker in that little tour plane. So he's off doing that when Larkin, he's, like, on his own. So he drives the sports car in the other direction, the right direction.
This DEA guy makes the worst decisions all the time. Why does anybody listen to him?
Yeah, why is there a DEA in the first place, Mike?
It's all bureaucracy.
Part of, like, the message of these types of films, right? Like, the average man has to take care of everything because the people in charge have their heads up their ass.
Because we spent a lot of time talking in The Rock about how Michael Bay just hates authority, right? And we sort of get that same message here, not from Michael Bay, but just sort of like government agents are inept and sort of not necessarily corrupt, but like maybe could be corrupt. They're just, they're not good at their job. They shouldn't be trusted. Yeah, you're right. Like, it's the average guys who have to save the day. And it sort of empowers the audience, right?
Yeah, and I guess, like, it kind of turns us against the cops a little bit more.
Definitely a thumb in the nose at the establishment. Kind of like that generation was what that generation was all about, too. It was cool to be badass. But it was right before the Attitude Era of WWE, which was all about anti-heroes and stuff like that, which is just what that generation wanted. This movie was right there. I mean, the main hero is a convict. He's a bad guy, essentially.
And speaking of that hero, speaking of being badass, like, we're on the plane and Cage kills another guy? Like, they're in the undercarriage of the plane, and Billy Bedlam is down there. I don't know if he's looking for anything in general or just sort of, like, looking around, but he finds Cage's box of stuff, and he remembers Cage telling Malkovich to sort of get in on his good side, that he's got 15 years left, but he finds this note that says, "My daddy's coming home today." He confronts Cage about it and then attacks Cage about it, and Cage impales him. Like, he kills him. Like, this is, like, another guy, death by hand. Like, you know, by bare hands count in this movie up to two, and for his career up to four.
Put the body back in the box.
I knew you was a punk, and I was right. You've been playing us all along. You a free man.
I said, put the bunny back in the box.
Anytime someone steps to Cameron Poe in this movie, like, I know they're going to die. I'm just waiting to see, like, how fast he's going to kill the guy, basically. He's going to get found out, pretty much, right? Like, this guy, Billy Bedlam's kind of been riding his ass the whole flight, giving him strange looks and shit, and it's crazy. He almost, like, unleashes the beast at this moment. No one's looking, and he murders a guy.
Why couldn't you put the bunny back in the box?
What I really like about that line is you have the most ridiculous words coming out of one of the, like, most intensely serious faces, you know, like, on screen. Like, he could not have said that more seriously. No one else could have made that play any better than Nicolas Cage made that line land.
It becomes a race to Lerner Airfield, that they're trying to get there so that they can get out with Sandino. Cusack's trying to get there to stop it. The DEA is trying to get there after they figure out that they went the wrong way with the Firebirds. Everything is converging on this one spot.
This is such a weird place, too. Did you look around and didn't notice any of those, what's in those giant piles of garbage, I guess?
Well, they call it, like, the boneyard,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it's like a junkyard, right?
There's an old gas station.
Well, it, like, is an old gas station slash, like, I think it's just, like, it's supposed to be, like, an airfield that's been there since, like, the 50s or something, and it's the airstrip that time forgot.
That's not necessarily an old gas station, because there's still people living there. Like, that little girl that Buscemi talks to later, like, she lives in a trailer right there.
Well, that's so, like, a trailer park.
Like, it's like everything, because like, it's still an active airstrip, because they're not the only ones landing there. Like, there's that little, there's the pilot and the single seat plane landing there.
It's not a commercial airstrip by any means.
It's just sort of like a derelict airport. Bottom line is that it's everything that this movie needs it to be. It's this place. It's this place to start off this amazing half-an-hour action scene. It's a place where they can encounter a few different, like, civilians. Like, they encounter the guy landing the plane. Cage talks to the guy who's, like, hiding under his plane. Buscemi talks to the little girl. It's like this magical wonderland that sort of unites all of Con Air.
It's like an oasis out there, right? Like,
is this maybe the place that Elizabeth Shue was gonna bring?
Oh, well, even this, like, what ends up happening here is better than what ended up happening there for those two that days.
And so Cusack catches up to the plane, and everybody's there. Con Air kind of has a crash landing, so they sort of, like, pull up and dip over this, like, little plane, crash land, and get a little bit buried in sand. This is sort of the beginning of their downfall, right? Like, things had gone so smoothly for them up to this point, but, like, that plane being there, it's, like, a little variable that they didn't account for, and it throws, like, a little wrench in their plans.
Yeah, and this is also where they're supposed to rendezvous with the cartel guys, right? When they land, the cartel's, like, nowhere in sight, so Malkovich is like, you know, we held up our end of the bargain, like, what's going on? Yeah, things are starting to unthread, right? Like, they want to execute the cops, but then Cameron Poe is like, you know, we need hostages, and everyone's sort of getting testy.
What exactly are we discussing here?
Poe, don't want me to off the pigs.
Well, it's not difficult to surmise how Nathan here feels about killing guards, and my own proclivities are well-known and often lamented facts of penal lore. What I'm wondering is why you have any opinion about it at all.
Cyrus, this is your barbecue, man, and it tastes good.
But I was just saying to Mr. Dog over here that if it was my barbecue, I'd wait for that old jumbo jet in the sky before I start killing the only leverage.
Shut the fuck up!
Don't you want to get high and get laid as shit?
No, fuck this!
Put the gun down. Put the gun down, Nathan. Poe's right.
But, like, it's at this point where everybody sort of goes off and does their own thing. Cage goes to guess just to look around. He runs into Cusack, and he's still a little hesitant of Cusack. Buscemi goes to find the little girl. Sally Can't Dance goes to get dressed up in his dress. A lot of the other people, like, Malkovich is sort of starting to get his defensive plans in mind. Like, everybody goes their own separate way. It's weird that, like, this movie was almost like a bottle episode. You know what I mean? Like, there were all these people on this one plane, and now all of a sudden, everybody's spread out over this entire massive sort of magical airfield.
Yeah, it almost feels wrong, like they stepped off the bus in Speed and the movie didn't end at that point. Like, it kept going for like 20 minutes. I kind of love this, though, because we get off the plane for a while and, yeah, we get some fresh air and Poe finally gets to meet John Cusack, and that's a great moment where they single-handedly, he like takes out the cartel guys. Like, he kind of comes across them by accident, and they were going to double-cross everybody, and Cusack is like, freeze, and Poe takes that moment to do his roundhouse kicks and his headbutts and his knee thrusts, and he's just a one-man whirlwind.
And they kill the entire cartel except for the pilot, and Sandino gets on there, and they're flying away, and then, as well-oiled of a machine that Malkovich is running, like, Cusack is almost one step ahead, because he, like, knows exactly where to go, lowers a crane onto Sandino's plane, and, like, destroys it. Like, Sandino gets off, he's like, hey, like, we were just coming to get you, and, like, Malkovich kill him, or does he just, like, or just sort of assume that, like,
he shoots the jet fuel that's leaking, and we get, like, the enormous explosion with Nick Cage running away from it in slow motion.
Oh, man.
The first of a few massive explosions.
Cusack is almost doing some action movie stuff now, too, you know? I'm not saying, like, he could do what Nick Cage is doing in Con Air, but I think he might be able to pull off what he did in The Rock, you know? He's kind of almost there here.
They do sort of make a good mismatched pair. Like, they're not as good as Cage and Connery in The Rock, but Cage and Cusack here sort of do a good job. They do a really good job a little bit later when they get to Vegas, but, like, it's sort of an uneasy alliance, because even though they're on the same side, Cage, I guess, is sort of unsure of where this whole detour that the plane took puts him in terms of getting back to his daughter, so he's not sure who to trust. But they do sort of team up, and they are both kind of like action stars, when just a couple years ago, I don't think you would think about that for either of these actors. We should probably talk about Steve Buscemi as Garland Green with that little girl, right?
That whole scene is creepy. Just the little girl there playing by herself is creepy.
You know, I almost wondered if the Buscemi character is so bizarre. Like I was saying at the beginning, like everyone, as long as you're doing like somewhere, if you're somewhere in the zone of what Cage is up to, like you're good. But I feel like Buscemi is like too good of an actor. Like we got all these great actors, but like he's way too good right now as like this, you know, pedophile murderous guy. Like he is just like, he's out of bounds, if you ask me. And I almost wondered at one point, is that little girl really there, or is he working out something in his mind? Is he talking to himself? Is this just a figment of his, is this what he sees every day taunting him, you know, like that drives him to murder? I didn't want to accept it as actually happening, perhaps.
He might have done that, because you see him wandering off by himself through this broken down barbed wire fence, which is symbolic in itself. And maybe that's the dreamscape he's walking into, you know, and he's created this whole thing with there's a little girl playing in this empty pool.
The setup itself looked straight out of like Nightmare on Elm Street as it was, right? You got like a tea party in an empty cement pool in an abandoned trailer park next to this old like runway. It was just so surreal.
Something else I was thinking about, he's such an interesting character. We get introduced to all these new personalities and characters when they pick him up in Carson City. He's so intriguing right off the bat, the way that he shows up on the plane all strapped in like that, and his brief history that you get. Not only is he taken as like this most evil character on the plane and most dangerous, I guess, but he's also the most interesting, and you don't know a lot about him. You start getting little peeks with when he starts talking to Cage on the plane.
Two went down, one came up.
One my fault.
Well, you don't have to tell me. Most murders are crimes of necessity rather than desire, but the great ones, Dahmer, Gacy, Bundy, they did it because it excited them.
Don't you... I got nothing in common with them, with you. Don't you talk to me. They were insane.
Now you're talking semantics. What if I told you insane was working 50 hours a week in some office for 50 years, at the end of which they tell you to piss off, ending up in some retirement village, hoping to die before suffering the indignity of trying to make it to the toilet on time? Wouldn't you consider that to be insane?
Murdering 30 people, semantics or not, is insane.
One girl, I drove through three states wearing her head as a hat.
It's my daughter's birthday today, so please feel free not to share everything with me.
This whole scene, the little girl, it just makes things so interesting because you don't know where anything's going to go at that point.
You know what else I thought was kind of interesting was that you said, like, all the other guys are, like, pretty physically, like, imposing and stuff, and they are, like, digging out the plane, you know, and, like, pulling the plane out of a ditch, and then they see the cops coming, and they're all arming up with the arsenal from the belly of the plane. Buscemi is just, like, not like that kind of guy, you know, like that's just not the type of like dangerous that he is. So maybe they used that scene to show, you know, just how dangerous he really is, right? Like these are guys with guns, but he's the guy with like the disease or whatever.
As all the prisoners are digging the plane out of the sand, Cage and Cusack are sort of figuring out ways to stop the plane from taking off, right? Like Cage takes his really sort of heavy duty rope and like ties it around concrete and ties it to Molloy's car. He's sort of going into like savior mode, like sort of save the day, right? He's trying to do everything in his power to help Cusack keep this plane from taking off.
Larkin and Poe are like, you know, what are we going to do? What are you going to do? And he's like, I'm going back on there or something. He's like, why? And he's like, because I'm going to save the fucking day, man. Like, it's as, at this point, it's just as simple as that.
You're a free man, Poe. What are you doing?
I can't trade a friend's life for my own luck, and that's all.
You got a friend on board. See, I knew I was right about you. I read your file. You're not such a bad guy, just always in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Goodbye, Larkin.
I spoke to your wife!
In person?
In person. And your little girl.
You saw Casey.
Uh-huh.
If this thing goes bad, Locke, then I'm afraid my daughter won't understand. If you talk to my wife again, you tell her I love her. She's my hummingbird. But I couldn't leave a fallen man behind. You'll do that for me, won't you, Larkin?
Sure I will. What are you gonna do for me?
What do you think I'm gonna do? I'm gonna save the fucking day.
But the plane does take off, so he tries to save the day, and he sort of slows things down a little bit, but he ultimately can't, like, it's still going. All the inmates are sort of, like, they're celebrating, like, I don't know if they really have a plan, because the plan was to get out with Sandino, so I'm not sure what the exact plan is now, but they're all sort of celebrating, and they're all dancing the Sweet Home Alabama, and there's, like, a little great line about how do you define irony.
Define irony. Bunch of idiots dancing on a plane to a song made famous by a band that died in a plane crash.
And, like, they don't realize that, like, they're sort of, like, the end of their road, their imminent demise is about to happen. They're just, like, the happiest people in the world right now.
They're the happiest people in the world because they found out that this airplane that was designed to transport convicts also had a sound system capable of playing music.
They know they're screwed. Like, there's really nothing they can do. So, like, why not just, like, go out in a blaze of glory sort of time? So, I don't know. That's almost what I saw. Like, I almost felt like if I was a convict in that position, like, I'd be partying and trying to get drunk or wasted one last time, try and get that one final good time in.
They're all celebrating, but, like, Malkovich knows now that, like, they ran into too much trouble. Oh, like, we didn't even mention, like, they're, like, the army shows up, right? These guys all show up to the airfield.
Yeah.
The only reason they get out of there is because, like, Malkovich had, like, this real, like, clever, like, we're going to take out the first car, the last car, trap them in the middle, kill all the guys. It's between that and, you know, the car getting tied to the airplane and all this different stuff that Malkovich is like, oh, we have a traitor on board. Things were going so well and now they're going so poorly.
Yeah, that battle in the boneyard was amazing. I saw this movie when it came out, maybe once or twice since, but forgot the majority of it. And this is definitely the kind of stuff like I had missed on cable. Like, I do not remember this boneyard battle. There's a moment when Cage, like, I call it Cage runs the gauntlet. You have the army shooting one way, you have the convict shooting the other way, and he's like running over cop cars and sliding over stuff and explosions everywhere. I'm so happy that all this just kind of happens here at the boneyard.
I wrote down, he's just like sprinting through the boneyard. Like, everybody's got a machine gun, armored cars, there's people in like riot gear, cop cars on fire, and he's just there like in his normal clothes, no gun, just like sprinting, like you said, running the gauntlet, you know, not getting hit by any bullets. Like, fate is on his side.
I noticed that this is the army now. Now, right? They have tanks almost, armored vehicles at least. They put all their strength down in this death tunnel.
Yeah, they are not tactical fighters at whatsoever.
They're in the desert. You can't surround them. You're the army. Surround them.
Very good points.
Oh, man.
They should have just waited for the choppers, but I guess they couldn't, right? I guess they're on a time crunch because they're getting that plane off.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I don't know if it's, I mean, like, the cops are very clearly the army or whoever's not good at a job, but it also maybe is a testament to how smart Malkovich is, right? He's just, like, he's running shit. Like, he's the man in charge. He's going to make sure that whether the plan is going according to plan or not, that they are in a good position. And so that's when, like, when they're on the plane, he realizes there's a traitor. Like, it doesn't concern him anymore. Like, Cage is almost, like, singled out, but Baby-O's like, no, I did it, man, I did it. And even though Malkovich doesn't believe him, like, he doesn't even care. He just shoots Baby-O, probably just to mess with Cage. And he's gonna kick Cage out of the plane, he's gonna kill Cage. And that's when Malloy and the Firebird show up, and they start shooting at the plane. It's like Cage is only saved. I guess it's sort of a little deus ex machina, right? Mm-hmm. Or maybe it's sort of the results of his actions finally paying dividends, that he was able to delay them at the Boneyard long enough for the Firebirds to show up and force this plane to a little bit of an unexpected landing.
Yeah, that's what I sort of took it as. His whole plan with Cusack was to just stall. Like, right. Stall them as long as you can. They're giving chase, which was cool. I totally forgot that, too. I was like, oh, how did they get shot out of the sky? And then, yeah, they show back up. And I don't know if you noticed, but those guys are actually sitting in the front seats of those helicopters for, like, one or two shots. So they must have taken them up, like Cusack and the other guy. They must have taken them up for a day to get a couple.
Which is awesome.
Yeah, that's great. I noticed that Cage... in Firebirds, too. They took Cage and they took Tommy Lee Jones, they must have taken him up at least once to get, like, a couple shots.
Well, I mean, like, if you're in a movie where, like, it's all about planes and helicopters, like, you better get, like, a fucking helicopter.
Yeah, it's funny, too, because now, like, everybody's airborne, you know? Like, it's turned into an air chase.
And this is when Cage has, like, his most badass moment, right? Like, he's sort of a man possessed. Baby-O is, like, crying on the ground, and he's like, man, I'm just worried that, like, I'm just afraid that God doesn't exist. And Cage says, I'm gonna show you God does exist.
I got a bad feeling, son. I feel like maybe I'm not supposed to make it.
You gonna make it.
All I can think about is, like, there ain't no God, but he don't exist. Hey, where you going?
I'm gonna show you God does exist.
And he, like, charges the front of the plane, and an inmate we don't really know shoots him in the arm, and Cage, like, does not stop. Terminator persistence, and just, like, walks up to the guy and, like, knocks him out. He goes into the cockpit, and I wrote down that he sort of has this little Captain Phillip moment, where he's just like, I'm the captain now. I'm in charge. They're like, we're going to land in Vegas. Like, enough is enough. Like, I'm taking over from the convicts. They're no longer in charge. It's perfect. Like, this is sort of, like we were saying earlier, the perfect culmination of Cage Club. So where else could this movie end other than Las Vegas?
Such a perfect spot for an epic climax, you know?
And when you're thinking about, like, where do you crash land a plane, the Strip is like a runway, you know? It just clicks so perfectly. Great idea right there. And Joey, like, he turns into a Terminator. You know, his will is just, I don't know, he goes like Super Saiyan or something. Like, you just can't wound this guy whatsoever. Yeah, I just love that when he gets shot and he doesn't even feel it. He doesn't even know he's shot, and I doubt he knew he was shot for another 10 minutes or so.
They're landing in the Strip, and, like, they take out, like, the Hard Rock Cafe guitar, and they're like, we're out of road, and they just sort of crash, and they crash into, not Bally's, unfortunately, they crash into the Sands, because the Sands was actually getting demolished at that time. And so when they found that out, they're like, oh, we need to work this into the script. And so, like, they see this hotel being destroyed, and that's actually the hotel being destroyed. Like, it's sort of like real life and the movie, like, combining to just create this ultimate action sequence at the end of this movie.
Oh, like when they blew up the hospital in The Dark Knight that they were going to demolish anyway. It's serendipity, man. They've already crashed in the actual sand, so it's kind of cool that they crash in the sands again.
Yeah.
They crash into the sands, and, like, it really seriously ends a 30-minute action sequence. Like, the last, like, or, like, you know, from, like, halfway through the Boneyard and all that stuff to this, like, it hasn't let up. And that's, like, what's great about these action movies. It almost feels, in a way, like the end of Furious 6, right? Like, they have that long, that 15-mile-long runway or whatever. It's this crazy plane just doing crazy things for a long, long time. And it's like, perfect. Like, there's no way that if you like action movies, you can't love this kind of sequence.
Yeah, this is why it's one of my favorite action movies. That whole sequence is just fantastic. I don't know about you guys, but I've always wanted to see an airplane that size land on the Las Vegas Strip. You know, it's like one of those moments. Oh yeah, where's he gonna land on the Strip? Oh, of course he is, and that's awesome. I can't wait to see that.
We have Cage, like, skydiving onto the strip in Honeymoon in Vegas. What, like, what's the next step up from a person landing on the strip? Just an entire plane landing on the strip. What's really kind of crazy about this movie, and I didn't remember this, this huge action sequence ends, and he gets onto the street, and he's all beat up. He sort of looks like McClane, like John McClane from Die Hard, and, like, he's, you know, all dirty and, like, cut up, and he just wants to see his wife. And I'm like, how is there still 20 minutes left in this movie? I remember that, like, Malkovich and Swamp Thing and all these guys, they're escaping on a fire truck, and so Cage and Cusack chase after them. And, like, so you just, like, you have, like, a deep breath, like, you have an exhale after this half-an-hour action sequence, because we're getting thrown into another 15-minute-long action sequence of this crazy chase through the streets of Vegas.
What's amazing is how many people survived the crash of Con Air. Even Baby-O, who was shot in the gut, survived the crash. Like, they're just arresting guys left and right. That was amazing. But yeah, then it feels like the movie's over. Like, everybody's just, like, gonna start congratulating each other. No, not so fast. Those guys, like, Cyrus, Diamond Dog, Swamp Thing, like, yeah, they, like, sneak out under the airplane.
Yeah.
And they all survived intact, too. Like, not a bruise on anybody. And then, for some, I mean, awesome reason, they steal a fire truck. But you can't all fit in a fire truck. And Malkovich has to, like, get on the ladder.
And that's the only reason they get caught, right? Because, like, they could just be driving away in a fire truck. But Cage sees Malkovich on the ladder. And so he and Cusack hop aboard motorcycle cop.
Oh,
motorcycle.
Awesome.
Like, they just take off after them. Like, they basically, like, look at each other, like, nod,
yeah,
and then just go off after
them.
They're
like, we're partners now, right? You bet your ass we're partners.
Cage, like, jumps onto the fire truck, and he's, like, doing, like, basically, like, he was doing the one-arm push-ups in Best of Times and Red Rock West. He's doing, like, one-armed pull-ups here. Like, he's just, like, so jacked and, like, showing it off. And he has this huge, epic fight with Cyrus. Cyrus is, like, hitting him. And then he jams, like, a pipe through Cyrus's leg. The truck crashes, right? And Cyrus gets electrocuted. Sort of for the second movie in a row, we have a guy's head get smushed. When, like, there's, like, this compressor.
Joe, you lost me, and I watched the movie, and I'm so lost right now. Like, so much happens at the end here. It's insane. Like,
and it all happens in, like, 4 minutes.
Yeah.
Like, it's all just, like, it's, like, this crazy chase, and then the chase ends, and then there's, like, a fight. And then Malkovich somehow gets, like, I don't know how this stuff happens. It all just sort of happens.
Like, I remember Cusack takes the hose and, like, puts it in the cab so he drowns Swamp Thing to make him crash.
Right.
Somehow Cage has Malkovich pinned to the ladder and extends the ladder so that it smashes into one of those walkways that connects
the
casino. Oh, and
falls off onto the wires, yes.
And he goes flipping up onto electrical wires, but he survives that and lands on, like, a nearby construction site, and then he's on, like, a conveyor belt into a quarry or something. I'm like, what is that?
Talk and about he your- lands perfectly every time to finally land perfectly where his head's going to get smashed by this thing. You just survived a plane crash, this chase. You've fallen all over all these things. You can't move a little bit to get out of the way from this thing squishing your head.
I mean, he's such a bad guy. Like, they can't just kill him. They gotta, like, mutilate, yeah, this dude. You know, like, he's, well, deader than dead.
That's also another good part, a point about this movie, is that all these bad guys get their karma and get their comeuppance. You know, they're such bad characters that they all have some kind of bad death, you know? Some kind of horrific death. A fitting death for a lot of them, too. Like, Billy Bedlam gets killed in a fight, and he was all about, like, anger and Bedlam. And Malkovich, he's supposed to be this real smart, conniving guy, gets his head smushed.
That's awesome. I like that a lot.
Well, I just love how this whole chase ends with, like, a truck full of money on fire falling from the sky in the middle of Las Vegas. It's just, like, burning, yeah, money in Vegas, baby. Like, you couldn't be, like, more on point with that imagery.
I feel like this is not the first time, I can't remember another time, but I feel like this is not the first time there's just been, like, money raining down in a Cage movie. Has this happened before?
I don't know. It's going to sound crazy, but it doesn't seem like the first time we've seen something like this in a Cage film.
So we were talking in The Rock about how Michael Bay has that like circular camera movement, right, to show how great these heroes are. In this, there's a lot of like badass guys walking away from things. Like when Malkovich blows up that plane with Sandino, they're all walking away from it, and he's just like walking in slow motion, and everybody else is sort of like panicked behind him. Like that's sort of his ultimate moment. And there's a lot of shots of Cage just sort of like walking away from things. The money truck, like it's raining money in Vegas, it's all being lit on fire, and Cage is just like walking away, not a care in the world except getting back to his wife and daughter. He fishes the bunny out of the sewer grate, gives it to his daughter, and his daughter's like scared of him. He's sort of like trying to reconnect with his wife, and how do I live is playing again. Right, like
guys,
a great way to bookend the movie.
I'm swelling up too. Like, I don't all of a sudden, guys, I don't care what you think, when he sees his daughter and that look where he's like, it's okay, you know, she doesn't have to take it, and the music and the, oh God, I swear, like, I got, you know, like, the feeling you get, like, right when you think you're about to lose it? Like, I got that feeling. It hit me.
Casey is sort of, which, by the way, Casey is higher billed than the mom. Do you know that? Like, in the credits, she receives higher billing than the mom.
That's insane. Wow.
I don't know how the credits are lined up, but on IMDb, she's higher than the mom. Anyway, just wanted to put that out there. So they sort of have their little happy family reunion. Cage and Cusack sort of have their, you know, friendship. Like, I almost wish, like, we were talking in The Rock about how we wish that there was a sequel to that, or that Cage and Connery could have teamed up. I would love to see a Cusack Cage buddy cop movie, criminal or former criminal and cop having a team up to do things, like sort of like working together more closely. Cage at one point in the movie says that he only trusts two men, and by the end of the movie he's like, now I trust three. Like, we never learn who the other man is though, right?
I assumed it was his dad, because he says something to Cyrus where he's like, my daddy told me one time, and then Cyrus is like, you know what my dad told me? Nothing. And then Cage is like, self-learned man.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I just assumed it was his dad. You're right, though, I would have loved to see these guys together again. We sort of get a little more action Cusack with Gross Point Blank, you know? Like, and he pulls that off really well, too. That's sort of more of a comical little action movie. It's too bad that you don't get more of these guys together.
Well, we're gonna get a whole movie of them together in The Frozen Ground.
Oh, but yeah, okay, then I stand corrected.
I don't know what that's about.
I don't either, but I'm glad that they will be reunited.
Cage has his happy ending with his family and with John Cusack, but the happiest ending of all is Garland Green sort of snuck away during all this, and they cut to a craps table. And then, like, does the shooter feel lucky? He's like, oh, I feel real lucky. And then he's just playing craps as the movie ends, like, basically a free man. The most horrible, evil, like, reprehensible villain in this entire movie, just free to go about Vegas like he's just a normal guy.
The guy who once confessed to wearing a girl's head as a hat across several states is now like a free man wandering the streets of Las Vegas.
And like popular.
Yeah, and it's like they don't notice he's missing. Like, we got the head count here. Oh, we're missing the worst one. We got all the other guys. Yeah, but we're missing the worst one. But we got all the other guys.
Close enough.
That reminds me of Chief Wiggum. Where's Sideshow Bob? If anyone asks, I shot him.
We also have, to sort of go along with the very weird Cage Club endings, we have, like, I think for the first time, the credits are the actor name, character name over, like, a silent video of them. Like, this is sort of, like, a weird, like, I guess this feels kind of very 90s, right? Or very, like, ensemble casty, at least. We haven't had this yet, right?
Yeah, this is something new for Cage Club by far. I was so glad to see it. I've seen it in a couple movies. The only one I can think of off the top of my head is Coming to America. But yeah, it's like this reprise of the whole cast or the major players, and they do it in Kill Bill Part 2, I believe, as well.
And Cloud Atlas. Cloud Atlas is kind of the coolest one ever, where they're just like, he was who?
Yeah, where like, everybody played eight people, and I love when they do stuff like that, because she kind of missed this, and it worked really well for this movie, too.
So I have some trivia about this movie, but before we get to it, is there anything else that you guys want to talk about that we didn't cover?
Baby-O? What the hell is that name? Who came up with that one? But if anyone noticed, he also played Bubba in Forrest Gump, was also shot in the stomach.
What? Oh, in Forrest Gump, yeah. That's right.
So within 3 years, this guy was shot in the stomach twice?
I did not know that this was Bubba, but the fate of this actor in the 90s, just, you know, who's the guy who gets shot in the gut best? Have you seen Forrest Gump and Con Air? We know that guy. Call him up. I just wanted to reiterate that if Cusack had taken the time to look at Poe's file when he was first getting onto the airplane instead of so easily dismissing him as a nobody, much of this stuff could have probably been handled. Sure. A little easier than it was, but since he didn't, and it was an oversight, and the government is known for making oversights, we get this awesome story that unfolds the way it does. Trivia time?
So it was brought to my attention by last episode's guest, Christian Larson, that the director of this movie, Simon West, also directed Rick Astley's video for Never Gonna Give You Up, so that's pretty cool. This movie was nominated for 2 Oscars. We already talked about Best Original Song. He was also nominated for the second movie in a row for Best Sound, but it did not win once again. It was nominated for a Razzie for Worst Original Song. It won the Razzie for the Worst Reckless Disregard for Human Life and Public Property.
Is that the landing on the Vegas Strip?
I think it's just the movie as a whole, you know, landing on the Strip, everything. So John Malkovich wasn't happy during production because apparently the script kept getting rewritten virtually every day, and he had no idea how his character was going to turn out. I think he turned out pretty well. You know, he's a pretty cool, pretty smart villain that sort of has a really cool death scene, but I can see that being really annoying.
Everyone seems really consistent character-wise, so that's kind of surprising, but I think where that shows is Malkovich's death, where they must have kept every version of his death and turned it into one big death at the end. It's like, get every draft and let's find out how he dies and let's make it one giant death scene.
John Cusack hates this movie so much that he won't be interviewed about it.
Really? What is that about? He's got a great scene where he's yelling at the DEA guy about, like, jurisdiction and stuff, and he's got to, like, unscrew the situation. I'm surprised he doesn't like it.
If we're talking about the ending, the sight of the planes flying in low formation over the Strip apparently caused a lot of people who live in Las Vegas to call the cops because they were like, we don't know what's going on, but something is going on.
Well, there you go with practical effects, right? I mean, nowadays they would just CGI planes flying close to the Strip.
Speaking of practical effects and a very sad little bit of trivia, the credits reference In Memory of Phil Swartz, who was an effects specialist killed on set when a rigged plane fell and crushed him.
Maybe there's an argument for more CGI and less practical effects. So
I mentioned that there was the cage in action that Jonathan Hensley did an uncredited rewrite on the script. But another cage in action, going back to It Could Happen to You, is that this movie was inspired by a newspaper article about a plane that transports convicts. So it's crazy. That's 2 cage movies in the last, like, 5 or 10 that were ripped from newspaper headlines.
Someone saw, like, oh, like, they put prisoners on a plane instead of a bus sometimes because it's a long trip, and they got this out of it. Incredible.
And so my last little bit of trivia is people who almost played other people. So instead of Steve Buscemi, the first choice was Tim Roth for Garland Green. I think Tim Roth probably could have done a good job. I mean, Buscemi just absolutely kills in that role. Instead of John Cusack, we almost had Robert Downey Jr., Charlie Sheen, or Matthew Broderick. I feel like Charlie Sheen doesn't fit there, but like Robert Downey or Broderick could do it. I think Broderick's probably the closest to Cusack. But again, I'm totally happy with Cusack there. Instead of Malkovich, we almost had Gary Oldman was the first choice for Cyrus the Virus. Kevin Bacon and Woody Harrelson were also considered. Or, in a really cool, would have been an amazing back-to-back Cage Club, Ed Harris was also considered for Cyrus the Virus.
Interesting. I could have also seen Woody Harrelson as Cameron Poe at some point in this movie, too, to be honest.
Well, speaking of Cameron Poe, I guess they wanted like a bigger name. Schwarzenegger, once again, feels like every time we talk about a movie, Schwarzenegger was offered the role. He was considered for the role of Cameron Poe, and so was Tom Cruise. What almost was, but I'm glad, I love the movie that we got. I wouldn't change a thing.
Yeah, I especially love the logo of Con Air that appears at the beginning of the film, you know, with like the screaming eagle and everything. Like, it's almost like tattoo worthy, to be honest with you.
It's basically like tattooed onto the movie, right? Like, doesn't it come down like whack and then just has like the credit right there?
I believe so. Yeah, and it's on the actual plane itself.
So that's it. Any last minute things that you guys want to talk about?
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thank you for being here. And if you want to come back, we can show you the list, but we always love having repeat guests to see how Cage sort of evolves in his career. Mike Mann's got anything to say? Any last words?
No, I'm good. This has been good.
So this was Con Air. You can go to cageclub.me for all things Cage Club. You can read our reviews for every movie, catch up on past podcasts. You can follow us on Twitter. You can follow and subscribe or rate and review and everything on iTunes. I'm Joey Lewandowski.
I'm Mike Manzi.
And I'm Mike Milnes.
And we'll see you next time on Cage Club.
How do I get through one night without you? If I had to live without you, what kind of life?